Hello and welcome to Face to Face with me, Mohammad Saeed Bahmanpour. Our guest in this edition of Face to Face is known to Press TV viewers. She is Lauren Booth. Lauren Booth has recently converted to Islam and decided to publicly announce her decision. But as predictable, this announcement caused some hostile reaction among the media outlets in the West. Today, I want to speak directly to her to find out what she wants to tell the viewers on this spiritual journey and its background. Lauren Booth, welcome to Face to Face.
Thank you.
Long journey, isn't it, Lauren? How did it start? From where you were before to Islam that you have accepted 6 weeks now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most journeys, when you set off, you actually know you're on a journey and you know where you're going. I didn't even know I was on a journey to Islam until I arrived at the destination about 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So I have to imagine where this journey began, because it was unknown to me at the time. I think that the first moment that I set foot in Palestine, I felt that there was something special about that region, and I felt immediately at home there. So if you can have an association with the soil and then with a people, then maybe that was the opening of the door, because until you've been to other regions, it's very hard to imagine what Muslim life is like. Now, there of course are Christians in the Holy Land, and always have been, and they the Palestinian Christians there welcome you exactly the same manner, and they're as strong in every way. The reason I'm talking about Islam is because this is about conversion. So thinking about the Muslim homes I've been into, I think when I first started going to Palestine regularly, I realized the absolute difference between what was written about Muslims from a Western perspective and what it was like being a stranger to a Muslim area was so different from what I expected. If I'm honest, I will tell you, I was scared the first time I went to Palestine. Mm. I thought that being blonde, I might be hated or spat at. I thought that being a Westerner, I'd be automatically ignored or I'd be treated with suspicion. None of these things happened. In fact, it was the opposite. On my first visit, the Israelis kept my bags, as is quite common if they know you're going to the West Bank. So I was cold. I didn't even know it was cold in January in Palestine. Can you imagine how little I knew about the area? I arrived in a light T-shirt, well, not a T-shirt, a shirt like this,
yes,
and trousers, and my big coat was in my case. So I got out, and I'm standing in Ramallah and 10 o'clock at night in the rain, thinking, what am I doing? I'm freezing, and there's lots of Arab Muslims around. And this lady came up and said, come into my house, dear. What are you doing? And gave me a suitcase of her daughter's clothes. Now, that's the Palestinian fadal, but it's also a lovely introduction into a generosity that I found across the Muslim world.
So you were attracted to Islam because of the way you were treated by Muslims, or there were things beyond that as well?
Do you know, I didn't actually know that I was being attracted by Islam. I just thought these people are remarkable. These Palestinian people are absolutely remarkable in their welcome and in their openness. And then it extended, and I'd go to other regions as well, and I'd notice that Muslims in the United Kingdom, when I'd talk about an emotional experience, if I gave a speech, for example, on Palestine, and I get very emotional thinking about Gaza and especially what the people there go through, and I quite often get choked during a speech and think, oh. Now, a non-Muslim say, people in journalism would think that was unprofessional and be quite cross about that. But without fail, when that's happened to me, and I've had a Muslim audience, the men have been crying and have had no shame in dabbing their eyes with tissues. And the women have hugged me and said, and there's this emotion, there's a rawness to these people that I didn't know existed. And I love that.
So this was how your exploration of Islam and the Muslim world started. And it ended up 6 weeks ago to a situation or to a sort of emotional moment where you decided to convert to Islam.
Can I stop you there? Because that's not quite right.
Okay,
I didn't decide to convert to Islam because that would say that I had any decision on my part or any kind of thought process. Can I talk about the process that happened to me?
Sure, of course. That's what we need to explore, yes.
So I went to Iran in September to cover the Al-Quds Day rally. And I was there for 8 days, just working in my role as a journalist for Press TV. And on the last day, I had 24 hours to do some sightseeing. And I was heading, of course, to that wonderful ancient city of Esfahan, or say ancient 16th century. And a fellow colleague said on the way, should we stop at Qom? Because it's pretty and we can be there in the evening and it really is a wonderful shrine to visit. And I thought we'd stop there for an hour. This was the plan. And then go to Esfahan where a lovely hotel was booked. And I'd do my touristic sightseeing. So you wear a chador, of course, when you go to holy places all across the Islamic world. So I had a chador on and I went towards the shrine where lots of women were touching, and there are metal bars around it, and holding, and some women were crying, and I thought, oh, their lives must be terribly hard. You can feel young women crying, maybe somebody sick in the family or something awful, and I felt sad. And some of the older ladies, their faces were raptured. They were enraptured by the joy and the peace they were having, and they tears down their face as well. And so I just touched the exterior where these ladies were, and I just said to myself, thank you, Allah, for this journey. I wasn't expecting to be here. I hope that my friends in Gaza can be looked after by you, and thank you so much for everything that you've given me. And I went and sat down, and that was it. I thought, I'll just sit here for a while and go. But when I sat down, I was overwhelmed with such a feeling of joy and rapture and peace. Peace is the best word for it. Tranquility of the absolute heart, that I never wanted to move from that place, just from sitting there, absolutely stationary, looking down at the floor, very quiet and still. And I couldn't even remember what pain would be like. It was like that. I thought, I wonder what pain is like. It was like I'd never know pain ever again in my life, and I'd never had a moment's unhappiness. And I was in, I suppose, a bubble. And then a young girl came over to me. She was maybe 22 years old, beautiful, lovely young Iranian girl. And all I could see was her face because she's in a chador. And all she could see was my face, chador. And I'm sitting quietly. And she said to my colleague, can you ask this lady if she's at peace? And I remember thinking, what a strange question. Of course I'm at peace. What else is there but peace? Nothing but peace exists. So I smiled and said, yeah, I am. And she said, I know, because I saw you across the mosque and something is happening. Can I sit with you? And I said, yeah, of course you can. And then her friends came over and then they were sitting around me and we were just sitting there quietly. And I don't know how long that went on for.
And you were not speaking to each other?
Not speaking, just sitting there calmly, just enjoying the peace. And then she asked to have her photograph taken with me to show her husband the amazing thing that had happened at the shrine. And I thought, okay, that's fine, something amazing's happened. I wonder what it is. Somebody must have something happening to them. And after a while, I've no idea how long this went on with. You have to ask my colleague. She said, we should go and eat now. And we stood up and I thought the feeling would go away and it didn't. It kind of went smaller so that I could function and move around. But this feeling of joy and lightness, it didn't go. I walked through the rooms, we went and ate, and all I wanted was to get back to the shrine. Are we going back yet? Are we going back yet? Are we going back yet? And my colleague said, we should leave to go to Esfahan. What do you want to do? And I said, I want to sleep on the floor. of the shrine tonight. Is that okay? She said, of course it is. Of course. So her and her mother, bless them both, you know, were reading the Quran, and we slept on the floor of the shrine.
For the whole night?
For the whole night. Well, on and off. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 hours here and then walking around. Mm-hmm. 2 or 3 hours.
Okay. So can we say that this was something guiding you from inside, giving you sort of inpour of peace and blessing, which then you translated it that you needed a new religion? Or
did I translate it? What happened was that the next morning I took part in the morning prayers, which is really something. To wake up in a shrine and do morning prayers.
And you knew how to pray?
Yeah, I knew how to pray because I had been going into mosques over the years.
All right.
I had, you know, this is going to surprise me now because I hadn't even thought about this. I have wanted to go into mosques before and I have asked how to pray before now, but it's never really occurred to me that that meant I was going to be a Muslim. It was just paying respects. It was just experiencing what my friends like to do. So I knew how to pray. And when we left the mosque, I was sure of one thing. I wanted the feeling to go away because I knew for sure that converting to Islam would be a really difficult path. And I knew that if this feeling carried on, I'd have no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then another voice in myself was going, why do you want this feeling to go?
Mm.
This great feeling that you're having, why do you want it to go? Why, what you want to go to feeling how everybody else is feeling in their daily lives and that rushing feeling and that heartburn and that pressure. I thought, well, I don't. Oh, dear.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that feeling was certainly overwhelming, which captured your soul, so to speak. Any of that feeling is still in you? Or?
Yeah, a little. Mm-hmm. A little bit every day, and some days quite a lot. But, for example, after I'd been back a week, and I'd been resisting converting, and saying the Shahada, and you know, quite scared, actually. I'd cried quite a lot, because I didn't know what was happening to me.
People here are not very used to crying, isn't it? Unless for certain things. And usually they are surprised when they see Muslims crying and say, what is the problem with them?
Here's an interesting conversation I had. I've got a very lovely family that I live with when I'm in Gaza, called the Al-Kafana family, who I adore. I've got a mother and my brother, Yasser, and his wife, Amil. And I thought I'll speak to them on Skype. And I said, yes, I think I had this experience and I may be thinking about converting. He was jumping up and down and I could see him and his wife. He said, okay, take it easy. No one is going to rush you. When you hang up this call, I want you to go into your bedroom and cry because you feel like crying. I said, no, I don't feel like crying. He said, I know in your voice, because we love you, that you need to cry now. And that's okay because Allah loves people's tears. Mm. Allah loves you to cry. And expect it when you're going through something very big. And don't hold it in like your other instinct. Let it out. So I thought, well, I love him, but what is he talking about? So I hung up. I went into my bedroom. I cried for an hour.
Mm.
I didn't expect to cry. I just cried for an hour because I thought, oh, I can't believe this is happening.
And you didn't know why you were crying?
It was like letting go of an old life, I think.
Mm-hmm. And, well, of course, did you think about the consequences then? I mean, you, Lauren Booth, well known here in the UK, worldwide, and now suddenly you convert to Islam. Mm-hmm. What about the media? What about the reaction in every quarters?
Part of the resistance that I was having after that experience, because when I came back from the shrine and came back to the United Kingdom, I really wanted to pray. And you know, I had a rug that I bought that was just kind of had from Esfahan, and I was praying and I didn't know the words. I would just say Subhanallah and Allahu Akbar and do the movements. I was doing that 3 or 4 times a day without really knowing what I was doing, just because I felt absolutely compelled to do it. Compulsion
you
is...
You felt the need for
I felt
it,
the, really the need. I wanted to wake up and pray, and I wanted to pray at night. And I felt that compulsion, and I can't remember your question. I'm sorry, I just remembered that feeling. Oh, yes, about...
Consequences.
The consequences. So I wasn't worried about the media at this point, but I was worried about how much of a change would be expected of me when I, if I reverted or converted, because that there's a huge amount. Is it expected of you? There's a huge change from Western life into Islamic life. There is a huge expectation, changes inside, changes externally. That I was resisting. And I knew that people would be shocked, that I might lose friends. The media, that's secondary. When you're going through something this big, really, you don't have much of a choice and you're not thinking about X, Y, and Z over there.
Okay, and what type of reactions do you actually did receive when you came back? Your family, your friends, journalists whom you knew from
a long
time?
Well, first and foremost, most importantly, is family, of course. So before I converted, I had lunch with my younger sister and my mum. And I told my mum about the experience in the shrine. And she was crying with joy, saying, that is so beautiful. And she, because I'm her daughter, she could really feel what I was telling her. And she said, imagine being touched with that. That's incredible. You're so lucky. I'm really jealous. This is marvelous. And I told my younger sister, and she said, that's lovely. We thought you would anyway, because of you're such a respecter of Muslim people and because of your work in Palestine. So I went back the next week, and I was wearing this scarf, and I saw my mother, and she said, why are you wearing a scarf? And I said, I told you I was thinking of converting. Well, I've converted to Islam. She said, Islam? I thought you meant Buddhism. What, those nutters? And she was really angry.
I see.
But she's been fine since. I had another talk with her, and I said, this is what it's about, and this is how I'm treated, and this is what it means. And then she was like, okay. But I think she's still a bit suspicious.
And was there any pressure on you from your friends, Muslim friends, to put on the scarf, or you decided to do that yourself?
There's been no pressure put on me from any Muslim I've met about anything in my life whatsoever. What's been impressed upon me from sheikhs, imams, scholars, all those who have shown an interest, who I've spoken to before coming out, as I did at the weekend, and saying publicly that I'm a Muslim, is this: you are about to make a contract with your God, and he will show you what's expected, and what's written will guide you towards him. Please don't feel pressured into being scared or unhappy or other people's rules that they put on this religion, because you will be guided by the words that are written and by Allah.
Well, a few years ago, you had an image of Muslims in your mind.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you yourself have become a Muslim. Reverted or converted, or whatever we call it. How different is that image now?
I'll tell you what's never talked about, and this has really struck me. How beautifully spiritual Islam is. From the exterior, praying five times a day seems fanatical. It seems crazy, and it seems unwarranted. It seems pointless and difficult and a little bit scary, quite frankly. That's how we see praying. I was also thinking that there's a dictionary that needs to be written. Maybe it has been, I think, between Islam and the West. When Muslims say Allahu Akbar, what non-Muslims are all too often are persuaded to hear is, we're going to kill you and we hate you and you're the infidel and we're full of hate. But when Muslims are saying Allahu Akbar, they're saying God is great. Mm-hmm. Isn't this wonderful that we're here together? Isn't it great that we've got this God? Isn't it great what comfort we get? And we hope the world can be a happier place. Why don't we hear that? I now hear that.
Mm-hmm. So the image is absolutely different.
Completely different.
And do you think you can actually convey this message to others who are not Muslims but have that wrong image? Yeah. Do you think you can do that? I mean, now that you yourself is a Muslim.
Do you know, I wonder if it's actually possible to reach people. I think a lot of people can be reached if they're already got an open heart and an open and a gentleness about them, I think they can listen and go, oh, okay, all right, it's just a bit of confusion then, let's see it like that and give Muslims a chance to convey that. But I also think that there's many people who are so trapped in consumerism and in hatred and in, you know, selfishness, that they'd never believe that we can live like this or we can be so happy. Can I just say that in the last 48 hours, I've had around 600 messages.
Wow.
To my Facebook and to my phone and to my email from Muslims I've never met from around the world. And they all begin with this line. I could really cry about this, actually. They all say, Salam alaikum, welcome to Islam. Mm. We love you so much. You're so welcome. You've made us so happy. This is the sort of language that we would never use to each other. Even within families, we find this difficult. Mm. In the United Kingdom and in the USA. Mm. Even towards each other, older family members. This, I would say, childlike outpouring of love. I only use that word childlike because it's very fresh and very gentle and very innocent, this innocent expression of love.
During the past 6 weeks that you, officially, I mean, something which you marked as a turning point, converted to Islam. What sort of experience did you have? Did you have new explorations of your own soul and self?
Certainly, from the time that I've got back from Iran, every day has been a different experience waking up. Questions like, who do I want to be at this point in my life? Well, what is a dignified purpose to this day? Well, what is the most important thing about being a mother and about looking at yourself? And if you are converting, then how should you dress? What are you going to do? So many questions. But you know what? It's felt really easy. I've woken up some days and I thought, there's so many questions to ask yourself now you're a Muslim. And then they've gone away and I've just felt very naturally inclined to dress more modestly and to give up alcohol. I am actually at a stage now in my life where I cannot imagine drinking a glass of wine. I can't imagine alcohol touching my lips at all. Mm-hmm. I think I know that I would spit it out. In fact, there was one night when I had friends around and I said, oh, buy a bottle of wine. And I took a mouthful and I spat it out in the sink just because I didn't want it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't any overwhelming urge. It was just like, I don't want it. That doesn't feel like it's me doing it, which is really strange. Mm. Yeah, it's strange.
So you were used to alcohol before?
Yeah, definitely. Like most of my generation, when we'd get together, we'd meet in pubs or bars, or we'd have a bottle of wine. It was perfectly natural.
So it's not difficult at all now for you? It's very naturally coming?
It's not even a question for me. It's just not there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned your role as a mother. Mm. I wonder, how did your children react to your decision? So, you have two daughters, by the way.
Yeah, I have two
very
lovely
pretty,
daughters.
Cute daughters.
Lovely girls. They really are amazing. They know, they hear so much about Palestine. Every day there's some talk in our household amongst the three of us about what's going on in Gaza or East Jerusalem. Alexandra has friends in Jenin and in Nablus. And so they're very much a part of my working life, and we share and talk about a lot of subjects. So when I came back from Iran, I said, I had this amazing experience. Really, really? Oh, that's so lovely, Mummy. So I kind of gently broached it. I think I might be becoming Muslim. What do you think? And they said, we'll get back to you. We've got a list of questions.
Oh.
So they went off and they wrote down a list of questions and came in very seriously, and they interviewed me about what I would be like as a Muslim mummy. And the first question was, will you drink alcohol? I said, I'll never drink alcohol again. Yay! Will you smoke? I said, I think I'm going to give up smoking as well. That's fantastic. And will you wear low-cut dresses or tops? I said, why do you think I do that? Do you think Muslims do that? They said, no, but you have been, and we really don't like it. And I said,
oh, really?
I promise you, as a Muslim, I would always have this area covered up. And they said, we love Islam.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, what's been really nice is my 7-year-old daughter has been getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to pray.
So they have already got a message from you, actually.
They've always had a message because I've worked in the Muslim world, that this is not a strange or a threatening area to be in, that this is a lovely way, and mummy's only going to be a better mother because of it and a nicer person because of it. Mm. So what more could children love? They love it.
Yes. Now, you have, of course, been an advocate of Palestinian cause for a long time, and everyone knows that you have worked, you have dedicated yourself to that cause. Now, some people may think that this conversion is more political than a genuine type of conversion. What do you say about that?
I think when you convert as a Westerner to Islam, or for me personally, no, actually for me personally, there is an ethical conversion here. There is a moral conversion. Mm. There is, in the way that there's an aversion to modern life that says that Muslims are collateral damage, that their children are not human beings, mm-hmm. that they are damage limitation exercises for the rest of the world. Yeah. I think there is an aversion to my daughters having to see women in thongs showing bits that they should not have to see on national newspapers. I think there is an aversion amongst many women of my generation and in the United Kingdom to the way we're expected to retain this kind of sexuality into our 50s and 60s at the expense of thinking of a spiritual process of giving ourselves to our family. I think there is a confusion. So if that's a political conversion, then I think that is part of it. Mm-hmm. I think that is what draws more and more women to Islam from my world.
Yes. And do you think that your conversion, because I heard that it's reported in Guardian, actually, that you have said that you hope that your conversion to Islam would actually help Tony Blair to give up his presumptions about Islam. Do you think this is going to happen?
No.
Are you hopeful about that?
But we can hope. Yeah. I mean, look, I can hope for a Palestinian state to be formed tomorrow. I was just saying that I hope. Mm. Do I think he'll be affected? No, I don't think so. I'm afraid that as a Middle East envoy, he has completely swallowed whole the Zionist narrative created to make Muslims into Islamists. Islam into a threat to peace and democracy. He swallowed that. My conversion will just won't affect that, but I can hope that it will.
Mm-hmm. And you discarded, when I asked you about the media, you just discarded the media and said, well, you don't care about it. But it's a reality. I mean, they are going to certainly have different reactions to your decision. And since last 6 weeks, of course, we have seen different reactions. How are you going to explain your conversion so that it's not the message is not taken wrong?
Do you know what? That's something that I'm kind of not struggling with, that I'm really questioning myself about at the moment. Because when I'm doing an interview with you, for example, and on Press TV, where I know a lot of Muslims will be watching, I can afford to talk about emotions and spirituality, and I know that you'll smile and you'll really understand. If I go on the BBC and talk like this, I'll be met with completely blank stares, because unfortunately secularism and consumerism has reached such a powerful degree into the people's philosophy, that anybody who talks about emotions in public is immediately something else. So it's about how to communicate this in a way that's understood. I suppose you can talk about values, family values. You can talk about good behavior. You can talk about ethics, wanting to help your neighbors. That's what I'd be talking to. But it's a pity that I won't. I'm trying to get to a stage where I'm confident enough that I can express to them how wonderful the feeling is when you pray with other people in this way. Mm. I wish I could. I hope I have the confidence to do that.
You will be able to do that. There has been also global reaction, media global reaction. How do you feel about that? Because I know there has been some hostile, very hostile reactions to your conversion to Islam from global media.
You know, I've avoided a lot of that because it doesn't matter. It's tomorrow's chip paper, and these 600 messages of support from around the world more than counter any of that. We know what's real and what is, you know, tomorrow's unimportance. But one thing did hurt me. Al Arabiya, an Arabic newspaper, printed really quite foul things about me in Arabic, not in the English version, in the Arabic version. And when they were read to me by a friend who speaks Arabic, I was shocked and hurt.
What did they say about it?
I don't want to repeat it. Disgusting things. Okay, well, I will say one thing. They said they were deliberately trying to slander my relationship with Palestine and the people there by saying that I went in a bikini in Gaza. Can you imagine going in a bikini in Gaza? They made things up. Now, I've spoken today to my friends in Gaza, and they said, don't worry, we know this is nonsense. Mm. We know where these people come from. We're friends. And just because I love the people there, I'd hate to see that damaged more than anything. Why would they try to do that?
That was my question, actually. Why would they try to do that? No one knows.
people in the Arab world will know more about this newspaper than me. I don't know what their agenda is, but that hurt. Because I'll tell you what, even the Zionist newspapers haven't told lies like that yet.
But you are expecting things to come from them as well.
Well, I tell you, we wait. I'll tell you what is interesting, though, when I speak to other Muslims and I say, they say, well, how do you feel about if there's some nasty media attention and being hated? I say, well, welcome to Islam. And they laugh and they say, exactly, isn't it terrible?
Yes.
So I can't expect to be treated any better than the woman in Bangladesh or Bangalore or Palestine or Bradford.
Yeah. Now, one very important question, although we have little time left. You, by entering the world of Islam, you have entered a world of different ideologies as well. Shia, Sunni, Salafi, Sufi, and all types of different ideologies, which of course, although united in the main message, but they have different views and ideas. How are you going to cope with that?
I am going to follow Allah's lead, and I'm going to not look for any particular... I'm not culturally or historically from an Islamic family. Mm. I don't know enough about the history to take a stance or to follow one teachings at this time. And I hope that everyone will bear with me, because it seems to me at the moment that Allah isn't demanding that of me.
Sure.
Seems that I'm being comforted by the fact I pray. Mm. And so I hope that I'll be allowed to pray in every mosque, and that I'll be able to do that, because that seems to be what's being asked of me.
Sure, and this is where you have been guided by Allah to just worship Him as a Muslim. And that's great and fantastic. What advice different shuyukh and religious people, prominent religious people, have given you so far after you have converted to Islam?
So the main bit of advice, go slowly.
Mm.
Don't try to become... to know all of the rules overnight, because what I hadn't realized is like 90% of Islam is actually hygiene and cleanliness. And the technical part, if you try to take all that in, you're overwhelmed and you fail every day. I don't want to wake up and fail as a Muslim every day. So what the kindly sheikhs and imams and scholars have said is, one day at a time. Are you being the best person you can be? Are you doing your prayers? Are you open to whatever message is there for you? Then you know what? You're doing okay.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because we have reports, accounts of the companions of the Prophet in the beginning, that early days of Islam, they said that we used to learn the Quran 10 verse by 10 verse, and we used to practice that 10 verses. And then we started to learn other things. So it's very good. Practice as you learn, and this is, of course, the best way.
You know, certainly. Something else that's really amazed me? My favorite part of the rak'ah, of the praying, is the supplication. I feel such comfort when I'm kneeling on the ground. Nobody talks about that outside the Muslim world. You guys are keeping a big secret there. That's very naughty of you, because actually that letting go... Somebody asked me, you know, what are your plans for the future? And I said, when I pray, I suddenly feel like somebody else is making plans.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say I don't function every day. I function as a mother and I function as a journalist and as a colleague. But plans, I don't have any. I just say, whatever your plan is, can you show me? And that's really a big turnabout.
So you have answered another of my questions. I was actually going to ask you, what are your plans for future? Now, you say that Allah will plan for you. Mm. That's a very good attitude to rely on God. But certainly, you should have some sort of program or blueprint in your mind now as a Muslim, what you are going to do. Of course, as a Christian, you were doing a lot for the cause of humanity. Now that you have converted to Islam, is there anything else that you are thinking of, not planning? Of course, Allah plans for you.
I hope that Allah will support my work towards bringing up the stories of Palestinian refugees from 1948, because they haven't been heard yet, and they haven't been publicized, and they haven't been digested by the world. So I'm hoping that's part of the plan. Hmm. And then, you know, my eldest daughter, she's 10. I have about 3 years till she hates me, and I lose her. I want to be around as much as possible for that.
Why do you think she would hate you?
Oh, you know, they rebel. So at the moment, I'm the greatest thing in her world, and I want to be there for all of this period. So as much as I can, I'm going to devote myself to my children and to the question of Palestinian refugees, if that's in the plan.
Yes. Now, if you allow me, I ask you, because certainly people do not come to this stage of faith and submission to God without a background. Now, if you allow me to ask you about your background as a person, were you religious? Did you have faith in God always, or it came about at a certain point in time?
Do you know, I remember I wasn't brought up in a religious household. My father was a lapsed Catholic. He'd left Catholicism, and my mother broadly believed in God. But I remember I was really strong prayer when I was about 7 and 8 and 9. I would go to bed and I would really, really pray. And I always felt that there was a God out there. And I've always known, really felt strongly there was a God. I remember once when I was in a club called the Brownies, which children here join, and I walked up to the cross at the front, and I actually backed away as if I was in the presence of royalty, which is what Christians do. Mm. That's not in Islam, that was before. But the idea of kind of revering a greater deity, it's been there.
It's been there. And do you think now that has evolved into something better?
Yeah, it's lovely that it's evolved. It's lovely that I don't have to leave Jesus behind.
Yes, of course.
You know, I always think the greatest Christians on earth are the Muslims, because they can quote more about Jesus than any of the so-called Christians that I know. This is what's really fascinating. I've learnt more about Mary, Jesus, and his time on earth than I did as a Christian.
Now, you said that you have received 600 messages. Mm. From around the world.
And they're still coming at 200 an hour. Ugh.
200 an hour?
It's a lot, yes.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. Doesn't this give you a sense of solidarity, that you belong to a global community? Something that, of course, previously you had a different view about this global community. Now you feel you are an insider. Does this give you that sense?
Do you know, it's interesting about this. Is the Ummah real? Is it a real kind of community? When I was in the shrine in Iran, and that young girl, she looked into my eyes, and before she left me, there's a young girl who came over while I was having my experience of peace, and she held her onto my shoulders and she said, "I love you."
Mm-hmm.
I'd never seen her before in my life.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "I love you." And I looked into her eyes and I felt as if she was my daughter, my grandmother. I was her child. I felt like we were the same person. It was amazing, the love just pouring between us. And, I knew I was in the Ummah then. And
In the Ummah.
Mm. I felt I was inside. I was no longer a tourist, visiting as interest. I was inside something.
This was before your conversion, wasn't it? Yeah.
Before I said the words, but was that the conversion? Was that part of it?
Of course. So you mean it was there and then that you converted, in the shrine of...
No, in my heart.
In your heart.
In my heart.
It was there and then in your heart, after feeling that peace and tranquility that made you to convert in your heart, and you decided that from now on you are a Muslim.
I made no decision. I made no decision then. I just knew that something radical had happened to me and that it would be very strange to walk away from it. But it was not a conscious thing. What happened is when that feeling failed to go away, when I got on the plane back to London and I felt compelled to pray, I thought, what is this? And I went to see some advisors and sheikhs and scholars, and they said, and you're praying. How many times a day? I said, 5 times a day. And you're praying to Allah. They said, you're already Muslim. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. Why are you coming to us asking if you should be a Muslim? Mm-hmm. You are a Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think now you are going to play a greater role in British politics, especially towards Muslims, now that you are a Muslim yourself?
I think there are perfectly good Muslim leaders here. I think that would be hugely patronising to think I should step up and take the place of academics and scholars and MPs. We have enough people here. Mm. I just hope that I can be helpful in conveying that there isn't an otherness about Muslim people, that they're not a strange tribe with weird cult things going on, that this is a nice family, natural religion that can make everybody happy. That's the only thing I should be doing, really.
Now, with the mood on Islamophobia, the Islamophobic mood that we have here, what do you think, now you as a Muslim, how can you contribute to remove this mood?
Well, what's been interesting in the press is the way that the British press have held back, actually, so, you know, about my conversion so far. They haven't been that rude. The Guardian's been quite good. There's been lots of jokes about it. We like jokes. That's mm-hmm. fair enough. Mm-hmm. Because I think they're scared of revealing the level of Islamophobia that lies behind the headlines of, you know, Muslim ripping off benefits, Islamic families taking our jobs, you know, Islamic terrorism. They're kind of withdrawing because they can't reveal too much, and by attacking me, that would be revealing a lot. How can we fight Islamophobia in this country? It's a hard one. It's a tough one. I think there is a revulsion by a growing number of people in the United Kingdom about the racism that's in a lot of the headlines. That's in our government's attitude to wars. That was in Tony Blair's A Clear Agenda. In a what became for him a holy war. Mm-hmm. And I think people are revolted. So I think actually the people rather than the headline makers are going to change.
Yes, yes. And do you think Muslims and non-Muslims who don't have that influence over them from media, over Islamophobia, what can they do in this regard?
Well, I think the unity that's shown on a lot of the marches that has been shown, for example, on the anti-Iraq march, where 1 million people came out of all creeds and nationalities and colours and thought processes. I think that sort of unity will make a difference. I think lobbying against MPs who try to bring in more targeting Muslims in the street, for example, like the sus laws, stop and search laws, young Muslim could be a terrorist. I think if we join those lobby groups, Muslim and non-Muslim, and say, there's got to be just civil rights. There's got to be just humanity. Mm. There's got to be just human rights. Let's stop this. Mm.
Lauren Booth, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there.
Thank you.
And I have to thank Lauren Booth again, and thank you for viewing the program. Until next time, goodbye.